Thank you for joining us for this final part of the seminar today, and I have the pleasure of introducing our last session. So David Cook and Susan Melmud will provide us with an update of the activities of the SAM Phase 2 subcommittee, including recent and forthcoming guidance. They will also include some of their own analysis on the appropriateness of the standard formula in specific areas, and go on to cover the Solvency UK and Solvency II reforms. What we can learn from those and whether it means anything for third country equivalents. And to bring it all together, they'll provide a brief update on the international capital standards and how it may affect South African insurance groups. So they may not need an introduction, but for those of you who don't know, David Cook is a principal with Milliman. He specializes in M&A, risk and capital management, regulatory change, and insurance strategy. Susan Melmud is a consulting actuary with Milliman. Her experience is primarily in regulatory capital, asset liability management, market and operational risk management, and financial reporting. So I'll hand it over to you two.
Thanks, Alicia. I'm going to do a very quick intro before handing back over to Susan. And I mostly think I need to explain the caterpillar, although Susan tells me it's not such a subtle reference. We've been very much focused on IFRS 17, many of us, for a few years. And it's probably time to start thinking a little bit longer term, looking at some of the changes that either are going to happen or maybe should be happening to solvency regulations. So the key theme this afternoon is around what changes might be coming down the path, what have we seen from Solvency II and Solvency UK and ICS, but also what is the work of the SAM Phase 2 subcommittee of the Life Insurance Committee, what areas have we been taking a look at? And of course, Alicia was involved in that subcommittee doing some work there as well. So the caterpillar is about change. I don't know that we're going to have quite the metamorphosis that caterpillars can go through. And my daughter tells me that lepidopterophobia is, in fact, a word. So if any of you suffer from terrifying fear of caterpillars, sorry, there may be some more in the presentation. So Susan's going to talk about Solvency II and Solvency UK developments. I'm going to touch on insurance capital standards and try to justify why this is relevant for sort of many of you rather than sort of 4% of you. I am going to talk briefly about the Life IBNR APN that's been recently issued. Had a couple of random conversations in an airport with one of the other authors recently, so we may work some of those comments in. And then we'll have a Q&A session at the end. Now, there's a problem with a Q&A because I'm not there, so I'm not going to be asking questions. So if you could please jot your questions down and get some questions in. You can even ask the hard ones. Susan will happily answer them.
Thanks, David. Right. Afternoon, everybody. I hope you've had some caffeine and you're all awake. So I'm going to just take you through the Solvency II and Solvency UK developments. So if you recall, SAM was based off Solvency II, allowing for some South Africa-specific country adjustments. So it makes sense that with any potential changes to Solvency II, we should be considering them under SAM. But also, more generally, it's good to keep an eye on international developments to just make sure that SAM doesn't drift too far from international practice. So just to start, let's have a quick look at what's been happening with Solvency II since it went live back in January 2016, which was more than 2 years ahead of SAM going live. The Solvency II directives that were drafted back when it went live, they explicitly required that there would be two reviews, one by the end of 2018 and the second by the end of 2020. So the first, the 2018 interim review, that just focused on simplifications and some technical issues with the SCR. There was actually one of the changes that they did make, did find its way into SAM, which was the infrastructure equity class in the equity risk submodule. And then the second review, which was the more meaty one, is the Solvency 2020 review. For both these reviews, the IOPA, which is the European Insurance and Occupational Pensions Authority, which is synonymous with our prudential authority, they provided technical advice on the review. So back in 2019, IOPA kicked off with its review over a two-year period. They wrapped up end of 2020. And then since then, I'm not going to bore you with all the details, but over the last couple of years, there's been many rounds of reviews and negotiations. Most recently, end of December, the European legislatures ultimately concluded or an agreed set of changes. And in April, I think it was the European Parliament then approve these changes, and now the final stop is for the European Council to approve these changes. So at this point, it's still uncertain when implementation will be, but the earliest that can be expected is early 2016. And just to give you a flavour of the size of this review, IOPA's consultation paper was nearly 900 pages across the three pillars, covering, I think it was about 19 different topics. So it was a substantial review. So we're going to have a look at some of the proposed changes to Solvency II shortly, but on the topic of Solvency II developments, we have now recently been seeing the developments in the UK for their own prudential regime. Now that the UK has exited the EU, they've got free rein to do what they want. So there is Solvency UK, which they've got a very unflattering acronym that they've dubbed as SUK, but that's what they've dubbed it as. So this is basically taking Solvency II as it stands in the current form, and they've applied or proposing a set of reforms to the Solvency II basis, focusing on simplifications, improving flexibility, and also importantly, encouraging entry into the UK market. So just quickly, what's been happening there, changes to the risk margin, actually already effective end of last year, and we can have a closer look at those shortly. Next up is changes to the matching adjustment expected middle of this year, and then all remaining proposed changes are expected end of this year, subject to final approvals. Okay, so now just to take a look at the selection of some of the changes, but firstly, obviously, as mentioned, there was a hell of a lot that was considered, particularly under Solvency II. So for this presentation, we're going to focus on stuff that's relevant to life insurers in South Africa, focusing only on Pillar 1, because that's just the focus of the presentation today. And then we're also going to look at both proposed changes and changes that they had considered but didn't actually make a change to, or didn't propose making a change to. So firstly, extrapolation of risk-free rates. Solvency II has proposed a change. It is different to what SAM does. I'm not going to get into the technical detail today. As you may recall, it was just, I think, last year that the Prudential, or our local Prudential Authority, did a detailed review of the curve that we used under SAM, and they issued a detailed paper with some changes that came into effect earlier this year. Then next up is the matching adjustment, or the illiquidity premium. This has been a particularly hot topic in Europe and the UK, given its prevalence of its use and its impact on solvency for insurers there. As you may recall, it's basically where you're allowed to take a portion of the spread of the backing assets to be reflected in the discount rate that you use to discount your associated liabilities under very specific conditions. So in South Africa, in SAM, we can only use a liquidity premium for life annuities under specific conditions. Under Solvency II, the proposed changes are mostly just clarifications, while in Solvency UK, they've actually proposed widening both the assets and the liabilities to which the matching adjustment applies. Then next, what IOPA did actually consider was whether it was possible to consider alignment of the Solvency II technical provisions with IFRS 17 liabilities. They concluded that this wasn't possible. The reasons that they gave was basically saying that the objectives of Solvency II was very different to IFRS 17, the granularity of the calculations were different, and also at the time, IFRS 17 was still being finalised when IOPA was wrapping up their review. But yeah, an interesting area that they did consider. Then next, Solvency II has proposed changes to the risk margin, the equity risk submodule, and the interest rates curve risk submodule. And Solvency UK, as we've mentioned, or as I mentioned earlier, has actually now already made changes to the risk margin. We're going to take a closer look at those in the next few slides. And then other areas of the SCR calibration that IOPA did consider was the calibration of the life underwriting risk, property risks, the correlations. They basically concluded, well, there wasn't any new data to suggest otherwise, so they didn't recommend any changes, but they did caveat that they were wrapping up their review just as COVID-19 was emerging. So it's maybe, you know, particularly for life underwriting risk, something that they might need to circle back to. And then more recently, so not part of the 2020 review, but IOPA has been requested to provide advice on the prudential treatment of crypto assets. So that's due by June next year. Locally, we haven't heard anything as yet from our PA, but what we do know is from the FSCA's perspective, they have increased focus on crypto assets. It was in 2022 when they declared crypto assets as financial products under the FASE Act, which means that any advice or intermediary services related to crypto assets in South Africa, those individuals or businesses need to be registered as an FSP. And then lastly, IOPA recently issued a consultation paper on the treatment of sustainability risks, both from a Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 perspective. They concluded that for now, for Pillar 1, there's not enough data or models to recommend anything, which Adele and Pam also talked to that point. And for now, they're just saying consider it under Pillar 2 under the ORSA, again, as we heard earlier. All right, so now we're just going to get into some of the details. So firstly, starting off with the risk margin. This faced a lot of criticism in the Europe and the UK, particularly with life insurers in the UK. The Institute and Faculty of Actuaries had a working party on the risk margin. They did a very detailed review back in 2019. We've got references to the paper later in the slides. But overall, they just summarized that the main criticisms that were coming through was the fact that the risk margin was considered too large. It had a huge impact to solvency of insurers. The fact that the risk margin was very sensitive or is very sensitive to interest rates, that it's incentivizing transferring risks to non-solvency II jurisdictions, particularly for your long-dated risks like longevity risk, which is particularly prevalent in the UK with a large annuity market. And then lastly, the fact that the risk margin is considered too inflexible. So it's a one-size-fits-all. You know, you've got the exact same formula and parameter specifications, for example, for your life insurers versus your short-term insurers. So just as a bit of a reminder of the risk margin calculation, got the formula there up on screen, the green factor we're going to get into now, that's a new factor that's been introduced. But both Solvency II and Solvency UK considered different assumptions, different methods. As mentioned, that working party paper went into a lot of detail of various issues that were raised, but ultimately Solvency II and Solvency UK landed on two sets of changes. First being on the cost of capital rate, which has always been a bit of a topical one. Currently under Solvency II, that's 6%, and SAM took the same rate that Solvency II had. The Solvency II latest proposed changes are reducing that down to 4.75%, and Solvency UK has now actually made the change even lower to 4%. And then the second change is introducing this new tapering factor, which is meant to allow for the time dependency of risk. So the argument there is that the current formula for the risk margin and the projection of the SCR doesn't allow for the dependency of risks from one projection period to the next over the lifetime of the contract boundary or over the product's term. So for example, you know, they give an example of saying, you know, you might have non-repeatable risks. So for example, cancer, if that event occurs in the one period, you don't expect it to occur in the next period, but based on the current formula, you would effectively be allowing for that. Solvency II for now has just said you must allow for the time dependency of risks, and they say the detail will be covered in the delegated acts. Solvency UK, with the risk margin now being already effective, they parameterized it as shown on screen for life insurers. For non-life insurers, there is effectively no tapering factor because the lambda is set to one. So you may be wondering, you know, there's all these sort of factors and how were they actually determined. There isn't much detail that appears to be available, and it seems that it was ultimately down to a lot of negotiations and political wranglings to get the risk margin down. So it was a case of let's see what plausible levers we can pull to get this number down. So just to illustrate the impact, to just appreciate the significant impact it has now for Solvency UK, for example, so the graph on the right-hand side is just showing it's going to show the profile of the runoff factor that gets applied to your SCR term. So just we can see now the beige line is what it would currently look like in this example under the current Solvency II by simply just lowering the cost of capital rate down from 6 to 4%, you see you get a fairly substantial reduction. And then introducing the tapering factor, you can see there's a very significant reduction in the risk margin with applying the floor, just softening that tail. So overall, you can see from this picture, both the level of the risk margin substantially reduces and the interest rate sensitivity has also been reduced a lot. So given that Sam literally copy-pastes Solvency II's risk margin formula, now Solvency II and Solvency UK are changing it. Should we, you know, for Sam, consider changing it? I guess on the question of the cost of capital rate, is perhaps maybe less pressure in the South African markets. In the UK and Europe, there was a lot of pressure to reduce the risk margin because of the impact on solvency. And there was significant concerns with solvency or being above one times cover. So that's less of an issue or less of a driver in South Africa. And then I guess in terms of just the interest rate sensitivity with us having higher interest rates, it reduces that impact of the longer duration contribution to the risk margin. But perhaps in South Africa, more of the topical discussion is around using a non-iterative versus iterative risk margin approach, which isn't something under Solvency II, but that is something that we do have available under SAM, subject to approval. Okay, next, just looking at the equity risk change. So as you may recall, for both Solvency II and for SAM, the equity shock is specified as base shock plus a symmetric adjustment. So the symmetric adjustment is meant to provide relief for procyclicality, which is basically saying that when markets have fallen, have a lower shock, when markets have risen, have a higher shock. However, it is limited to a corridor of plus minus 10% under Solvency II, and SAM took the same corridor as well. So in Solvency II in UK and the Europe, there has been concerns that this corridor has been too limited, that there hasn't been enough short-term relief during market stresses or market rallies. So, for example, during COVID-19, there were questions that there wasn't enough relief provided there. IOPA, in their analysis, they considered a fairly wide corridor of 17%, but ultimately the latest Solvency II proposal is looking at a 13% corridor. So just to illustrate the impact or potential impact for SAM, looking at local equity and the symmetric adjustment from 98 to earlier this year, the beige-yellowish graph is without any corridor applied. Then adding the 10% corridor is the red graph, and the dark blue is widening it to 13%. So as you can see, in some of those market falls and market rallies, so for example, in the 07-08 crisis and then the recent COVID-19, you would have got more relief to your equity risk during those market crashes. So again, given that particularly the corridor assumption or parameter that was set for SAM was taken directly from Solvency II, do we want to actually consider a similar change under SAM? And then lastly, just to look at the interest rate curve risk change. So just as a quick reminder, Solvency II's got a term-dependent relative shock applied to the nominal curve only. SAM, same as Solvency II, except for a different calibration, but we also do shock the real curve. The concerns under Solvency II was the fact that actually the interest rate risk was being understated, and there were also concerns that the negative rates were not being shocked. So there were actual experiences of negative rates getting more negative, and this wasn't being reflected in the standard formula specification. So IOPA has proposed recalibrating using a relative shift method, which basically allows for both additive and relative term-dependent shocks. Apparently, this is quite common amongst internal model users and is considered a good approach where there's a low interest rate environment. And then they've also proposed shocking the negative rates, but applying a floor to that. And the latest Solvency II proposal has gone with IOPA's proposal, but they're also just suggesting that it just gets phased in over a five-year period just to make sure that there's no extreme shocks to the market. So again, given that there's a lot of similarity from SAM to Solvency II, should we also be considering similar changes? I guess with negative rates, that's much less of a concern for us. Whether the relative shift method could be better, we're obviously not in such a low interest rate environment, and I know at the time when SAM was being developed, there was, looking at more detailed methods with principal components, so maybe less of a concern, but nevertheless, it's maybe still worth the question of whether, just re-looking at the calibration with more recent data. So I've taken you through a lot of detail, a lot with in a short space of time, but there's obviously a lot more detail behind this. Got a few links there, which you'll be able to access after the slides, but now I'm going to hand over to David.
Thanks, Susan. The reality is, if we were implementing SAM for the first time now, the way we did it in 2018, we probably would have just followed those same tapering programs and cost of capital programs and equity symmetric adjustments. So it's interesting whether we will or won't change. I may touch on a few more of those items down the line. I've been trying to get to grips with some of those tapering and adjustment changes. I keep going back to Susan saying, but do you understand why there was the way it was? And she keeps on saying, well, no, it's because it's aimed at how do we decrease the risk margin to make longevity business look less terrible. And that really is why it is. Even that long IFOA paper, I think they spoke about the different tapering factors that you could apply. And I think they concluded, maybe 2 or 3% is as much as you could do. And then we're at a 10%, or 1 minus 10, 90%. So even the detailed work doesn't really seem to be supporting it. So that's Solvency II and a little bit on SAM. I'm now going to talk about insurance capital standards. And for a while, I forgot that in 2017 or so, I did a presentation with one of my US colleagues on insurance capital standards. And I thought, slightly embarrassingly, that it had mostly kind of gone away in a staffing environment. I hadn't heard that much about it. One of my colleagues from Southeast Asia asked me, what's going on with ICS in South Africa? I said, no, I don't know that there's all that much happening. We have SAM group reporting. And I described SAM group reporting to him, and it seems to cover all the major things. Of course, the two internationally active insurance groups in South Africa have been doing quantitative impact assessments on this every year since then basically. And I guess I'm going to try to touch on why it may be relevant to more of you. This was developed by the International Association of Insurance Supervisors. In many ways, it is a parallel to the Bank for International Settlements, creating Basel, which is then adopted by many local regulators, and that's where it filters down. Now, obviously, in the banking space, it's far more important that everybody operates on a consistent, similar set of regulations because they are interacting with one another all the time. A little bit less so within insurance, but maybe the internationally active insurance groups, maybe there's a thought there that there may be enough systemic risk to make it worthwhile. The aims are to promote global convergence and improve comparability. The IAIS are having a meeting in South Africa later this year. And the idea is that at that meeting, they are going to agree and finally approve this, and that it's going to go live in 2025. But exactly what go live means isn't that clear to me, because ultimately it is a process of individual country-level regulators adopting this and implementing it in the country. But also adopting it might just be as much as saying that they need to prove to the IAIS that their local group reporting structure that applies to those internationally active insurance groups is at least as conservative as ICS. So my understanding is this is going to be, at the very least, a many years-long process, and there's going to be no big bang for us in 2025, but there may well be some learnings going around. Old Mutual and Sanlam are the only two internationally active insurance groups in South Africa at the moment. There are a few other names there that you will recognize. You may be asking yourself, why on earth am I telling you about all of this, right? There'll be a couple of people here from Old Mutual and Sanlam. But the one thing is that we need to demonstrate ongoing compliance with ICS. Therefore, even if SAM group reporting was deemed to be acceptable, every few years some work's going to need to be done, probably by those large insurers, to prove that it's going to be enough. But here's where things get a bit more interesting. Any of you, those of you who've been involved with SAM group reporting, how do I put this? Well, let me put it the way somebody else, and I won't mention his or her name, said, in terms of SAM group reporting, we're all just making it up as we go along. That is the state of the clarity of the standards, the maturity of the standards, and how it is being applied. We are still coming up with big differences and big questions over time. And actually, this isn't only about SAM. Solvency II has some of the same issues, whereas ICS was built from the ground up to be a group standard since it only applies to groups. So maybe there are things that we could learn from ICS to plug some of the gaps in interpretation application of the SAM group reporting. SAM is supposed to be this principles-based standard, but as Susan was talking, I was thinking more and more how those, like for the risk margin, it's no longer just a principle, it's now rules. It's harder to understand, well, this is why the risk margin makes sense. It can interpret everything in terms of that principle. It's now just follow those specific rules. ICS still seems to be mostly principles-based. So it's possible that SAM group reporting could be informed by ICS, in which case any of you who are involved in SAM group reporting would start seeing some elements from ICS come into that. So that's one reason to care. But then South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan already have actually adopted a form, a slightly modified form of ICS for their own local reporting. So if you've got subsidiaries in some interesting countries, it may well be that you'll be seeing ICS results rather than other results. So again, it may well become relevant. There's a bit of a push for this to be more relevant globally. It may well be that if you have a subsidiary in Southeast Asia, in China, and parts of Africa, they aren't doing Solvency II. They sure as hell aren't doing SAM. To coax them and prompt them into doing some sort of standard for you to have those figures to report yourselves without having to go and redo all of it centrally, it may be an easier ask to actually get them to do ICS rather than Solvency II or SAM. If they've got US parents or even some European parents, ICS may well be more palatable than Solvency II. And then there's the other question, which I think may make some people nervous. There's an idea that maybe, either optionally or voluntarily or somehow different, more than just the internationally active insurance groups in South Africa might end up moving onto ICS. And exactly how and why that would be, I've heard it put to me that maybe there would be a bit of a burnished reputation, say, ah, yes, we are following ICS, this higher, better, stronger standard. I don't know about you guys, but I'm not sure anybody's going to volunteer to do an additional different reporting just to be able to say that they're doing it. I don't personally see there's a whole lot of benefit in that. And then the question is, how many different bases do we really want to tolerate? Those of you who know me know that I disagree with Andrew Warren. I think embedded value may be around for a little while longer and that there's value in it. But I mean, Andrew's not wrong. Having another basis to calculate numbers is a bit of a pain. And having IFRS and local SAM, or solo SAM and group SAM and EV and ICS, at some point there's going to be a riot. Okay, so I'm going to touch on a few similarities fairly quickly. It's broadly a risk-based approach, assets at market value. The liabilities are supposed to be market consistent, however you define that. It includes a risk margin, although the risk margin is different. The capital requirement is intended to cover a 1 in 200 scenario. Management actions and policyholder behavior are very, very similar. And the equity risk includes a neutral adjuster dampener, which is very much similar to the equity symmetric adjustment. So clearly, there's been a lot of cross-pollination between Solvency II and ICS, in the same way that if you remember the insurance core principles, which is a set of standards from the IAS applying to solo insurers, there's also a lot of overlap with Solvency II. Okay, but the similarities are boring. Let's talk about, we'll get to the differences in a moment. This is the balance sheet. There's some different terminology here. We have a margin on current estimate, which I insist on calling MOCHE, M-O-C-E. I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce it, but I call it MOCHE. And then a current estimate rather than best estimate liabilities, but it's a very, very similar sort of idea. Some key differences. ICS has consolidation as the default for within insurance companies, whereas banks and other entities would be used aggregation and deduction to bring those in. So that is different from what we have as a default in South Africa, but there's been a move over the last few years for some insurers recognizing that there may be significant diversification between businesses, particularly between non-life and life, have been applying to use the consolidation method. So this might even be pushing it a little bit further along. And a little part of me wonders whether maybe we should just bite the bullet and do consolidation for all group reporting in South Africa rather than having multiple different approaches and having to apply and apply. That doesn't really seem to me like it promotes consistency. Contract boundaries. ICS is completely consistent with Solvency II, but it's a sometimes confusing to me, less known fact that how we treat a contract boundary under SAM is different from how Solvency II treats it. And weirdly, this actually came up in the review. There was a clarification put out reminding people applying Solvency II that what you do is at the contract boundary, you don't assume any future premiums beyond that point, but any benefits that are related to past premiums, you do keep modeling. And the simplest example there is a unit-linked, pure unit-linked investment contract. We treat it as a zero contract boundary, and we just don't do any actuarial calculations. In Europe, you take your existing fund value, you wouldn't model any future premiums or contributions, but you would model fees and expenses and have a discounted cash flow valuation and all the SCR stresses coming along with that. So it's quite different. And ICS is very much consistent with what Solvency II does there. That one is interesting to me. We had many, many debates at the time. I was involved in those discussions. And there are reasons to think that what we did in South Africa is could be better, but it is a point of inconsistency, which reminds me of another thing. As Solvency II and Solvency UK depart from what we have here, at what point do we need to ask ourselves whether Solvency II is still equivalent to SAM? No, I don't want to do it. Relax, right? It would be fairly catastrophic. But there's a question there. At what point we start saying these numbers are no longer comparable? Incumbent assets are more defined, and that's been a bit of a headache for a few of us over in recent years. And there's a difference in some of the calibration. The currency risk is a bit weird because they don't have all the currency pairs that we may want to apply in South Africa, and there are different stresses based on different currency pairs. The health underwriting risk I'm not going to talk about, and the catastrophe allowance is also different. Now, in terms of other reasons we should be re-looking at our SAM calculations, some good work done by Adelia Hoberg and some others have showed that there's kind of credible evidence from COVID that the mortality catastrophe stress is insufficient. Right? Many of you would experience that. I think you need to assume that COVID was a far worse than a 1 in 200-year event, which I don't think many of us do, to say the mortality catastrophe component is adequate. So again, another reason to maybe be looking at that. Then the MOCI, the margin on current estimate, is a very IFRS 17 type calculation. I love how things all come together. So it is not a cost of capital-based risk margin. What it does is it says, well, let's assume what our 1 in 200-year point is based on the calibration. We've got our mean from our technical provisions, and the MOCI is the 85th percentile that's read off a normal distribution, I think it is, from that point. So that should sound very similar to how many of you have been calculating your IFRS 17 risk adjustments, even down to the 85th percentile not being such an unusual point. So the MOCI doesn't suffer from the same massive interest rate sensitivity that the Solvency II risk margin does. So it was considered as part of the Solvency II reforms, and in many ways I think it may have been a neater solution. And no retrenchment shock, which is maybe not such a big surprise because retrenchment risk is a bigger thing for some of our insurers here than some other markets. Okay. Equity risk, though, the stress for South Africa, along with all developing markets, is 48%, which is quite high. The original calibration of the South Africa general equity stress was a little more conservative than what the data suggested. In my mind, I thought that given what we experienced the last 10, 14 years, be it COVID, be it the UK debt crisis, be it the Ukraine and so on, surely our markets would have been more volatile in the last 14 years than before. Turns out no. The most recent 14 years, when you add that data to what I've done before, our equity stress is actually becoming down rather than up. So stomaching a 48% equity stress is quite something. But if we are going to want to use SAM group reporting and prove that it's consistent with ICS, there's probably going to be fairly little appetite to take an equity stress, which is already lower than 48%, and decrease it further. So this is where paying attention to ICS may affect our lives. I might be able to motivate for a 35% equity stress for South Africa, but if we move down that path for solo reporting and SAM group reporting, it may well be that we start failing the at least as conservative argument for ICS. So it may well be that we don't change it. We may not increase it, we probably aren't going to decrease it because of this issue, which is interesting. Okay, clarity on currency risk. And this is a biggie, because I'm not convinced if we got, had a poll here on how we treat currency risk for SAM group reporting, I think we'd have an enormous spread of what's done. Solvency II rules clarified, they didn't change things, they clarified that in group reporting, whether you're doing aggregation and deduction or consolidation shouldn't matter, that you need to be stressing in the group the currency piece on the surplus of own funds above SCR for a subsidiary in a foreign country. And I'm not sure how many of us are doing that. The idea being that if the currency changes, all the assets and liabilities in SCR of the MC will move up and down together. And from a group perspective, you don't really care too much about that. But if you had 100 million contribution from own funds and surplus of SCR from that subsidiary supporting your group solvency, and that currency depreciates, the 100 million rand is going to depreciate. It's going to shrink. And therefore, we should be holding capital against that risk. Slightly counterintuitively, if there's a deficit of own funds over SCR, which can happen, especially when moving intergroup transactions and reinsurance, and we will touch on reinsurance, you're actually exposed to an appreciation of the foreign currency. So ICS is very, very clear. Everything gets stressed. Solvency II has been clarified how the treatment should be there. And I'm a little bit nervous that we don't have consistent practice in South Africa. So again, whether we just clarify what we do or whether ICS will actually be a change, I think is potentially quite a biggie. Reinsurance under ICS is always allowed. There's no such thing as a non-equivalent jurisdiction, which makes sense because it's supposed to be a standard that applies to the entire world. This is very different from what we have in South Africa. South Africa, if the reinsurance isn't in an eligible country, and there are some small things you do with collateral and so on that can moderate it, but basically you don't get to take that reinsurance into account at all. And you start having particularly African subsidiaries, particularly with mandatory reinsurance placement in the country, and sometimes some not amazing credit ratings, you can end up with some very, very weird, not helpful impacts of completely blowing up the SCR requirements for these territories. And of course, add on the method to cat risk in the non-life insurance space. So blow up some non-life cat modules, blow up the stress and not take the reinsurance into account. That can have a material impact on your group solvency figures. I don't believe it's a helpful number. I don't believe it's helpful to say, well, let's hold capital against this default, but that's the way the standard reads. And I know for a fact that this has been clarified exactly like that to some insurers. So it's not theoretical. It's maybe awkward is what it is. Solvency II, Susan, correct me if I'm wrong, there you get to allow for it anywhere as long as it meets a minimum credit quality step or credit quality. And obviously anywhere within the European countries is fine as well. So some differences there. But ICS says reinsurance allowed everywhere. And I think that is the correct direction for this for group reporting in South Africa as well. It'll be more straightforward, more consistent, and it will allow more comparability. That's not to say that I think the same should apply for solo reporting. There are arguments for and against that, but there are different reasons for solo South African reporting. And then all government bonds are treated as risk-free under ICS. Solvency II says, again, European region bonds are treated as risk-free. Everyone else is treated as risky. In fact, though, for internal models in Europe, you need to prove that the assumption of European government bonds being risk-free is appropriate. So there's no kind of absolute free-for-all there. Now, we have our own questions around the exact nature of the risk-free nature of South African government bonds. We had the discussion today around a new risk-free Zeronia, which I found quite interesting. But it's weird to me that Germany and Greece are both treated as risk-free within Europe, but you can understand why. It's very weird to me to think that Germany or the US and Lebanon or Ghana or Venezuela are both all treated as risk-free government bonds. So this is a more interesting one, and I think at the very least we need to do a lot more work in terms of Pillar 2 and also stress testing on how we think about those risk-free government bonds. But again, at least it's very, very clear what the rules are. I don't want to do the poll asking you how you treat government bonds in your non-equivalent or non-South African subsidiaries, allowing for default on those. It's even hard to wrap your head around exactly how to do it, right? Because if those assets were to default, which liabilities would move along with those? But again, likely at the very least, any surplus contribution of own funds to a group should be exposed to these risks. And as Susan often reminds me, there needs to worry about hypothecation of assets and so on. It's a bit of a mess. So again, I don't know that we're actually doing this correctly, but I don't know what is written makes any sense. Okay, so that was on ICS, and hopefully I've given you some difficulty digesting your tea, but there are reasons to at least be paying attention to it. Now, slightly more prosaic, we're going to talk about the Life IBNR APN, which was put together by a lot of work from the SAM Phase 2 working groups and subcommittee. There are a few members over here, so again, we'll direct some difficult questions to them. But I'm going to first start with a few sort of smaller updates on some other elements. We've had a discussion for several years on how to treat homogeneous grouping for lapse risk. And the answer is we're not going to put out any guidance on this at all, but this is maybe a bit of a public benefit interest announcement. As a reminder, the FSIs say that you're supposed to be putting your policies into homogeneous groups before applying the lapse stresses. And if by grouping at a less granular level, you would significantly increase the capital, then you need to use less grouping. That's about as clear as it is. Maybe slightly better put than I put it there. What's clear is that different people are applying different levels of grouping, that auditors are applying different levels of scrutiny. There can be some differences here. What was clear is that there's not a lot of appetite to change this. There's not a lot of appetite to go down to an individual policy level. And there are some good reasons to always think about policies in homogeneous groups moving around. Whether we are able to defend our homogeneous groups that we had pre-IFRS 17, now we're taking a different look at homogeneous groups from an IFRS 17 perspective, is maybe an interesting question. Also in the works, in fact, actually at the last year, this is how slowly things work. At the last live seminar in Cape Town, I spoke about the workings behind this information note that we're planning on the SCR treatment of short-term provisions, and it's now at the Professional Matters Board. We're going to hopefully get a draft of that out fairly soon. Basically, what this is saying, what do we learn from COVID-19 experience of raising short-term provisions for excess mortality? And did we also have to stress those provisions, the short-term provisions for mortality risk and for catastrophe risk? Were we stressing mortality on mortality and expense and how different portions worked? So we put together a note, lessons from COVID-19, lessons from a survey, from some of our own thinking. It's just an information note of things to think about next time something along these lines happen. We also had a discussion around ALSI versus SWIX as an index. There were some insurers who had experienced, if you like, a form of basis risk, where the equity symmetric adjustment was based on the performance of the ALSI, but their portfolio, they felt, more mimicked the performance of the SWIX. So you have a slightly weird scenario where the counter-cyclical adjustment was actually making your SCR cover more volatile rather than less volatile. I don't know how widespread this issue was. In the meantime, the SWIX and the ALSI have actually been getting a little bit closer together. And my understanding is that the SWIX is going to be done away with and many of those ideas incorporated into the ALSI. So this issue is going to more or less go away. Although it does raise the question about our equity calibration and whether it was based on ALSI or SWIX or new SWIX or old SWIX and so on, and how the equity symmetric adjustment might apply. So there could be some noise there. Again, if you like, more reason to be re-looking at some of the calibrations. Excuse me, sorry. One of the most troublesome issues we've had, and we've made very little progress on this, is on how we treat short contract boundary business. A contract with a boundary longer than a year, less than a year, exactly equal to a year, and how that forms into the SCR. The FSIs are not consistent here. It's unclear. They use different words in different places. And in fact, some of these scenarios just aren't addressed at all. The major issue, I guess, is if you have a group risk contract with an original contract boundary of 1 year, on average, you're going to have 6 months left. Do you only hold SCR in respect to those 6 months? Or do you recognize that you're probably going to be renewing it? And what level of management actions might you conceivably be able to assume in that six-month period? But again, we've actually made pretty little progress on this. We are hoping to make some over the coming year. Credit quality steps. I think you would have seen the note from the PA saying just watch out for a few things, not always being consistent with CQSs. Maybe they'd seen some CQSs above the sovereign cap, and they use very correct wording here. Normally, that wouldn't be appropriate. We've got a working group which is newly established just to look at, okay, well, what else can we do on CQSs? Is there any more guidance that can be provided? I personally feel it's a little bit of a waste. So many of us applying our thoughts independently to the CQS on a set of events that many of us have in common. We'll see where that gets to. And then there are a range of microinsurance topics looking at things like, well, what does IFRS 17 do to our asset and liability measurement? What do the definitions do in terms of the capital requirements? So you can look out for some more news from those. So that's where we've been heading to on some of the other discussions. On to the Life IBNR. I'm not expecting you to be able to read it, but just know that it exists. It's out there. It is APN 116. And when we set out to create this APN, I thought we'd be having to have the discussion on whether we need to have an SCR component for IBNRs. The answer is yes. But in that process, we had to answer the question around whether you should hold an IBNR as a provision in the first place. And so let's be clear. The answer is yes, you should be holding a life IBNR. There are lines of business where this matters most, and it's pretty obvious. Group risk business, short-term funeral business, credit life, everybody in that area knows that IBNRs are critical, and they hold IBNRs. There's no discussion about it. Some other lines, you're thinking, well, maybe we're actually holding a little bit of IBNR implicitly in the prospect of liabilities. There can be arguments there. And the APN, we don't say you must hold the number and show it. We say, well, if you aren't going to show an explicit number, you need to do the work to prove that it's definitely enough. And the counterexample I sometimes use just to make it clearer is if you have a book that has completely run off, and it ran off like a month ago, there will be no prospective liability by definition. But there could still be some claims that you don't know about. So in that trivial case, it's clear that there would need to be an IBNR or some number. One of those interesting airport discussions I had was someone saying, well, hang on, if I've convinced myself that my prospective liabilities have enough for an IBNR, then for Sam, I'm good. But IFRS 17 makes my life more difficult because I need to separate my liability for remaining coverage, i.e. the prospective liability, from my liability for incurred claims. So it's a bit more awkward to say, oh gosh, I know I really need to be holding this number. It is definitely a liability for incurred claims, but it's actually currently sitting in the liability for remaining coverage. My maybe unhelpful answer is that, well, it should be sitting in the LIC, so just do the work and hold the explicit IBNR in the LIC. It's probably simpler trying to do guesswork elsewhere. Okay, we'll get that point. And then, yes, you should be stressing the life IBNRs for your SCR. The FSIs are not explicit on this, but it is a source of future variability in basic own funds. It is a source of variability in future cash flows, and the non-life insurers have got no debate into the question around whether there's SCR that arises from having IBNRs. So I think that is a fairly settled point. We actually thought for a moment whether we should try to apply or recommend applying non-life techniques to the IBNR stresses, the claims reserving processes to life IBNRs, but the reality is we can't create regulation, even that we should, but all we can do is put out guidance that works within the framework of the FSIs. So yes, you should be stressing your life IBNRs, and basically you're going to apply the stress, the mortality stress, the morbidity stress, the retrenchment stress, and that's 50%, may well be too low, but it's still a 50% stress in the IBNR. You apply that stress to the number, and you have it flow through your numbers. There are some areas where it may be a little bit more complicated. Retrenchment claims are going to be for income payments for a while, disability or loss of income payments. There may even be some interest rate stress in there. You're going to have to apply some common sense around how material all those elements are. If it's a big deal for you, you're going to know how to do that sensibly and consistently with the FSIs in any case. And yes, please don't ask the question. It's obviously not a perfect stress. Obviously, the prospect of mortality, you can ask the question. Obviously, the prospect of mortality stress is a different set of stresses than an IBNR, but this is what we have to work with. There's no other lever we have to pull within the FSIs. Of course, non-life IBNRs are a little bit different. There's uncertainty in the number of claims, the amount of claims, claim development patterns, whereas in life insurance, for the most part, it's just did somebody die or not. So the amount and extent of variability is a little bit different, but I think hopefully you will agree that there is variability there. Covered that guy and that one. And yes, clear point, proportionality and materiality still apply. That hasn't changed. For some of you, this will be a minor item. For many of you probably will already be doing this, but for those who matters quite a lot, it's important to be included there. Not the only reason for this, but one of the reasons this came up is a smaller insurer that was struggling, and let's just be clear, that insurer is no longer with us. Amongst the many problems that they experienced, they didn't hold an SCR for IBNRs. Any number, and in fact, I think they can't recall now if they actually held a proper IBNR. So the insurers that are well capitalized, the things are doing well, this is all fine. This is really more kind of advice and guidance on those insurers who are maybe spending a little bit of less time on their resourcing. And yes, if you're holding a retrenchment IBNR, the stress on that is 50%. So it's rather higher than the mortality stress, and therefore can be quite a big, meaningful number, although for many insurers, this does diversify away quite a lot. Okay, so there's been a significant review in Europe and the UK. It's taken years and 800 and something, 87 pages or whatever. Informally, I have heard that there is appetite for a review within the Prudential Authority, but on what timelines, to what extent, how the process will work, what level of industry interaction remains quiet. I think there are many, many other things on their plate as well. So I think it's unlikely we're going to get changes for several years. But there are a real set of imperfections at the moment. I've spoken about mortality catastrophe. I can't recall whether Susan mentioned explicitly, but some research that has been done does suggest very explicitly that the interest rate risk module is too optimistic. It is not conservative enough. Life Ivanovs, we've spoken about retrenchment risk. You know that there is an APN out also on retrenchment risk saying that the standard formula is probably too low. We've spoken about risk-free government bonds. I have a pet peeve on the asset concentration risk module, whereby including government bonds in the denominator, we're actually completely diluting the concentration risk module, because investing a whole lot of risk-free government bonds doesn't change your concentrated exposure to another risky entity. I think I've touched on most of the items. But yeah, these are all things that really could deal with a fair amount of review and change, and some of these may be material. And I think that is then it. So on that very conclusive note, we will wait for Delisha to come up here and field some questions for us. Thank you for your time, but we'll hear some questions.
Thanks so much, David and Susan. I think you managed to pack quite a bit into that presentation. So I think let's start maybe in Joburg, if there's any questions. Not seeing hands.
Is it time for me to log into Zoom and quickly put some in?
You're welcome to. Okay, so there is one on Zoom, so I'm just going to read that one out. So how does the current treatment of foreign government bonds under SAM group reporting align with ICS? Are insurers treating government bonds owned by a foreign subsidiary as risk-free in CPD and concentration modules in the DNA method?
Okay, so I'll give my view on what I think. I don't obviously know what everybody's doing. My sense, and as a reminder, ICS says all government bonds are risk-free, and SAM says very explicitly that South African government bonds and guaranteed bonds, etc., are risk-free. My sense is that insurers are not applying default risk to foreign subsidiary government bonds. And I think that is awkward. And I'm not sure it's really workable to be able to do it, so definitely a challenge.
Hey, thank you. That was the only question. I'm not sure if there's... Oh, there's one down there.
David, for that effort, you can't only just get one question. You need one more. On ICS... Does ICS speak a little bit more about fungibility and transferability than Solvency II and SAM does? Because maybe that's the key to understanding those differences on currency as well as foreign government bond risk. I mean, your currency example made me think the reason they say that under Solvency II is because of their thinking on fungibility and transferability. So I think if we think about that in the context of a accounting consolidation-based standard, it may help. So just sort of pure question, do they say something about it?
Yeah, thanks, Jack. And fungibility and transferability, as we know, has been a difficult area. We tried to get grips with it. You are finding gaps in my detailed knowledge of ICS. My recollection is that they are more explicit on these items, but I couldn't give you a good answer on how they treat it. But thanks for the question, even if I couldn't really answer it.
I think your suggestion of logging into Zoom yourself, David, encouraged one more question. So I think, Susan, maybe this one's for you. The justification of the lambda factor reducing the SCR on which the COC rate is applied each projection year seems interesting. Isn't the SCR at time T plus 1, on which you calculate your COC, supposed to assume that the best estimate experience was realized since time T?
So I think if I'm understanding the question, yes, it's supposed to be allowing for the time dependency of risk, so the fact that if there is an expected risk in the one period, then in the next period, you wouldn't expect a similar risk.
Yeah, so I agree with the questioner. I think there are more questions than answers here. Mm. So I think it's important to think about cost of capital in two components, at least. And this is probably an MCEV type process, but I think it is useful. The one is the cost for the risk, right? How much we want to be charged or be reimbursed for that risk, assuming that there's nothing else going on. And then there's the frictional cost of having to hold actual capital and incur actual tax on the investment returns on that capital and eventually incur some expenses on that capital. And that second part for me seems to be missing from much of the Solvency II and Solvency UK discussion on the risk adjustments, the risk margin going forward. Because that is very clear, you are expecting to hold that SCR at that point. That is a best estimate process, and therefore the frictional costs will be what they are. So there, I haven't yet managed to understand how, from a frictional cost perspective, the relative expecting to hold an actual SCR future point is done away on this basis. Some of the arguments I've heard talk to the shortening of liabilities as you move forward in time. That sounds a lot to me like somebody isn't adequately recalculating the SCR. Maybe the proxies aren't quite right, because we should be able to allow for SCR to decrease over time as the risk decreases, and that then is a predicted SCR question rather than a tapering or a cost of capital perspective. I think in South Africa we've maybe done a little more work, some of us a little bit more work in terms of proxies and drivers from an IRM or iterative risk margin approach. So maybe the level of sophistication in the UK and Europe here isn't quite there. But the other portion of it is this kind of cost of residual non-hedgeable risk or cost of the risk piece. And there seems to be some sort of idea that, and maybe again linked into IRM, if bad things happen, well, at that point thereafter, you've had your mass lapse events, and now there's going to be less lapses down the line. Okay, but that's very familiar to an IRM sort of process. And many of the working parties who've looked at this have said that for many insurers with a lot of diversification, that's a small impact. We generally know that if you've got a massive mass lapse component and you're not that diversified, you get much bigger benefits from IRM than if you're more diversified. So that seems like they're thinking something along those lines. And the working parties also look at the issue where there can be the other way around. Risks can be positively correlated, so having one risk happen may drive more risk in future. I can't shake it that whatever justification there might be, it's still a little woolly, and the process is really to say, how do we decrease our risk margin? And partly, that is linked to Brexit. Where the UK says, now we can compete, our economy is sucking, are we allowed to say that? I don't know. As a result of Brexit, how can we attract more financial services players to the UK by making us more competitive? In fact, they're quite explicit about some of those comments about the funds moving away to non-Solvency II jurisdictions. So now there's a little bit of competition between the centres of insurance and finance in Europe and London as a centre of finance. So again, longish answer, but that really is what my thing is at the moment, that there are a lot of bad reasons for tapering and a lot of very pragmatic reasons for tapering. There might still be some reasonable actual justification for some of it, but nothing close to the levels that's actually been put in place in the UK.
Thanks. There's another question from Peter Withy. So you mentioned that it is unlikely to see changes in the SAM standards. I feel that most of the recommendations are focused on reducing SCR. Are there risks that need a heavier weighting on some items, and we see an insurance failure that could have been avoided?
Okay, I'll have a go, so you can add if you like. First of all, I don't think we change the SAM formula in the near term. I really hope that it will be over time. Like having it set in stone and safe for 100 years is obviously crazy. So I think it will happen, but not soon. These are long processes. The Solvency II review started in 2020?
2019.
And it's not all going to be implemented now. There are other things from EIOPA around catastrophe risk and so on. So it is continuing to develop. Next thing, I don't actually think any of the changes up or down would have saved or stopped any of the insurance insolvencies we've had in recent years. I did comment that one of those guys maybe didn't have the piece there, but it's still mostly a red herring. The risk of failure are unrelated to pure solvency. Those businesses were beyond that. One of them had a negative SCR cover. A refinement in your SCR is not going to help you when you have a negative SCR cover. Solvency II and Solvency UK have, by and large, been trying to move the capital requirements down. Trying to think if there are any that push it up from their proposals. Some of the catastrophe changes, which are still coming, those will push it up. In South Africa, it seems hard to say that mortality catastrophe shouldn't go up. I still feel retrenchment should go up. Equity rates should probably come down. Interest rates should probably go up. Who knows what climate change may introduce. There's some more interesting things on the non-life side, which we won't bore you with, except to say, I think IFRS 17 work to look at risk adjustments has been really informative. I think there can be some claims and reserve risk quality parameters that might need to go up. but some premium volatility factors might need to go down. And I'm actually quite proud of the work that generally the Life Assurance Committee does and the SAM Phase 2 Committee does, that we're not trying to let's lobby for industry to make the numbers lower. We actually are trying to look at what are the right things that needs to be done. So Peter, thanks for the question. I think that our range of items can move up or down, and hopefully in you know, a five-year horizon, we may get some traction on some of these.
Great. Any last takers? No, then I think thank you very much, David and Susan, for sharing that. And I'm sure, maybe there'll be more conversations about this going forward. And I'm hoping you've interested some people to join the Phase 2 subcommittee.